The Sunstone Theological Society presents Liberating the Captive, Human Rights from a Religious Perspective. Recorded live at the 1988 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 17th through the 20th, 1988. We take you to the University Park Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Okay? No. Microphone's not on. It is on? I just need to speak into it more. Is that okay? How's that? Shout? That's better? Okay. It's a little uncomfortable, but that's okay. I'd like to welcome you all to this session this afternoon. This is Liberating the Captive, Human Rights from a Religious Perspective. And this session is sponsored by Amnesty International. My name is Mike Spurgeon. I'm the coordinator for Amnesty International for Utah. I'm also on the Death Penalty Advisory Board for Amnesty International, which is a national board, advisory board. For those of you who don't know what Amnesty International is, Amnesty International is a human rights organization that started 25 years ago and works to publicize the plight of human rights abuses around the world. We have members and groups in 60 countries around the world. We have well over 500,000 members around the world. We started very simply when an English lawyer read an article in a paper that two Portuguese students had been put in prison because they raised their glasses in a public restaurant in a toast to freedom. From that lawyer's outrage grew this organization. And with us today are some members of Amnesty International and people who have worked on human rights issues and have come at it from a religious perspective. And so we thought it would be good that they shared their views with you. So without any further introductions, I'll just start at the top of the list. Our first speaker today is Buckley Jepson. Buckley's been a local Amnesty member here for about 4 years. I've been working with Buckley since he started working with Amnesty International. And he's been active in the groups here on all kinds of issues. And he's also an editor at Peregrine Smith.
Thank you. My remarks today are going to be very personal, sort of based on my experiences in the trenches of both the church and working with human rights with Amnesty International. The issues addressed by Amnesty and others involved in the human rights movement are very much in keeping with Christian doctrines and the doctrines that we have in the church. People are held captive literally and figuratively in many places all over the world even today. And as Christians, we believe that that God cares about each and every one of his children to the same degree and is not a respecter of persons, so this certainly should be something we pay attention to. The issues are especially important to Mormons. We should remember that in the not-too-distant past, many members of the Mormon Church would be classified as prisoners of conscience or certainly victims of human rights abuse. We have a history of having been denied the right to worship according to the dictates of our own doctrine and our conscience. We have been imprisoned, tortured. We've had our voting rights taken away, even executed. And so we should be particularly sensitive to the issues of human rights and guard them jealously. In fact, some of the articles from the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, put together by the United Nations, sound very much like articles of our own faith. To quote a couple of them, all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. They're endowed with reason and conscience and should act toward one another in a spirit of brotherhood. Sounds like a conference talk. The family is the natural and fundamental group unit of society and is entitled to protection by society and the state. And another, everyone has the right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion. Yet on the surface, it seems that institutionally and individually, we're a little lax in our addressing of human rights issues. Amnesty International is by far the largest human rights organization in the world and certainly the largest in Salt Lake City, if not the only one. Yet a quick count on my hand finds one active member of the church involved in Amnesty International, and that's me. In preparation for this, I contacted the Public Communications Office and the Church Office Building to find out if there was any high-level involvement in human rights or if that issue had been addressed either within the Church Office Building or addressed maybe in some speeches or some statements by the church. They weren't sure, but did some research for me, and after several days got back to me and said that as far as anybody could tell, nothing had ever been said. Does that mean that the church is officially not involved in issues of human rights? Of course not, as we all know. They're involved in education, in family issues, in women's issues, in religious freedom, in political lobbying, civil rights, and most other of the concerns of human rights. They've spoken out on the environment, on nuclear proliferation, on the violence within our society. They built irrigation systems in Ethiopia. We sent plane loads of food to Africa. We've worked at the St. Vincent de Paul Center here in Salt Lake. We recently donated a building to the Salvation Army. So certainly all of these things show that the church as an organization is involved to one degree or another in human rights. But there is no specific office that takes questions or makes policy or disseminates policy on these issues. And this is certainly going to become an issue as the church grows, especially in places like Latin America, where human rights is really on the edge and in a very delicate and fragile condition. And I do know, having been on a mission in South America, in Colombia, where it is notorious for its human rights abuses lately, that we certainly, the church has to walk a very delicate line in a number of ways to be careful with the government. And so I think this seems to spill over a bit into the way the church officially looks at human rights. But I would like to see an office address that. But anyone in the church knows that the action of all of our lives in church does not happen in Salt Lake City. It happens in the Orem 97th Ward, in the Cross River State, Nigeria Stake, and in the Layton 18th Ward where I reside. Human rights is an individual issue and more than an institutional issue. And on the individual level, the church influences us almost every aspect of our lives, from what we eat and what we wear to how we act. To outsiders, this seems a little strange, and many times we're criticized because we seem to be a little bit clannish or provincial. But these outsiders don't spend 3 to 6 hours a week in church meetings on Sunday and countless hours helping people during the week and building the kingdom. Anyone who thinks that this tightly knit group is really doesn't care about issues is not aware of what it's like to pay 10 to 15% of your before-tax income over to the church, a lot of which goes to help the poor. Nor has anyone who's critical like that stood next to me for 15 hours cutting up tuna heads in a cannery so that somebody somewhere down the line can have a can of tuna, or stood at the end of a seemingly endless row of onions needing weeding on a church farm. Most of us, I mean, we do that because we believe that there are people that need help, not for selfish reasons. And most of us in this room will never see the inside of a bishop's welfare storehouse unless we are a bishop or something. But all this activity and giving to our local organization is very good because it creates in us a sense of selfless service and teaches us discipline, teaches us good behavior. But it has a downside as well. I find that it causes people to believe that personal performance is enough at the expense of a greater commandment, which is to reach out to our neighbor. This preoccupation with personal performance occasionally has taken on some sinister directions. I remember a few years ago, everyone was terribly concerned with developing their own personal relationship with Christ. If they'd gone to any four-year-old, they could have told them how to do it, which is love your neighbor and love God. The way to do it is very clear. So they lose sight many times. And this is not just, I don't think, simple charity, but an active way to participate, for Christians to participate in the guarantee of the rights of everyone who are God's children. So I would appeal to members to become aware of the human rights abuses around the world. I know it's an important work. I think it's important that we break out of our congregation and stretch out our branches across the waters of the world and rescue those that are caught in the indignities and the capriciousness of their own governments, and work for somebody else besides Mormons occasionally. The Ensign has an article in the current one that addresses this issue, I think, in support of this point of view. The idea of reaching out beyond and helping those other than our own is certainly something we all need to improve on. The Amnesty International office here in Salt Lake, we took a call recently by a woman who was very willing to write letters to help a prisoner of conscience, but she requested that the prisoner of conscience be LDS. Somehow, I guess, she felt like that was more of a worthy cause. And while we realize how ridiculous that is and sort of smile, still, there is an underlying feeling there that helping our own is where it's at. I personally find a great satisfaction working for human rights for the major reason that it requires no reward. It's very difficult to do things that require no reward, and it certainly is something that we aren't used to in the church because we think a lot of our reward hereafter, or we are rewarded with satisfaction and with other things in the church, if not money, certainly. But to write letters to get a Russian Hare Krishna out of prison or a Pentecostal minister out of a labor camp, you don't do that for any reward. You only do it because you recognize the inherent nature of the importance of that work. I never know if the letters are ever received. I never know because they're seldom answered. I won't know that he knew that I was working for him, that I'll never have that warm spot knowing that I affected this person's life eternally. You don't know that. You just do the work. And then you find out maybe someday that they were freed. Maybe you never find out. But not working or working without a reward is very important because that's what true Christianity is about. We believe in the church that Christ came and fulfilled parts of the law of Moses and put in its place a higher law, that lower law being composed of hundreds of petty little personal behavior preoccupations, and replaced it with something that required love and required caring and required keeping our thoughts as well as our actions in line. And he told us that if we weren't able to love our enemies and those that despitefully use us, then all of those little petty personal obediences weren't going to have the same effect. For example, he taught us, and I think we need this today. For example, he taught us that we should go to the prison and visit people in prison. I'll try and avoid asking for volunteers to tell us how many have visited the prison this month. But how much harder is it to go to the prison and just care for a convicted murderer or rapist and instead leave behind our row of onions on the church farm? And I think if given the choice and we asked our Savior, where would he rather we be, he would tell us comforting people in prison. At least that's my feeling. We can't wait for church headquarters to get involved. It's they have enough problems to worry about, and they're always going to be a little bit behind individuals in some things. Love cannot be dictated as a policy or a program, as anyone who's ever done home teaching in the church can tell you. Love unfeigned must come from the individual heart, and I know I, for one, have a long way to go, but working on human rights has helped me understand this to a much better degree, a much higher level. And it's helped me reach past a previous obsession I had with being good onto another level I think it's a lot better, which is doing good. And I find that a lot more consistent with the teachings of the Savior. And so I would admonish you all that that working for human rights is one of the highest things we can do, and one of the most selfless things that we can do as members of the church. And we aren't involved as much as I'd like to see us be. So I hope you'll think about it.
in the last few years when I've been working with Buck, working on, excuse me? Hearing? Is this? Yeah, neither.
This one is much better.
They told me we need to use the mics because they're recording, but maybe if everybody could move forward then, real, and speak, if we speak louder, does that help? Okay. I guess you got to eat the microphone, as they say.
Close, okay.
Anyhow, as I was saying, in the last couple of years that I've been working with Buckley on campaigns to free different people around the world, he's never told me that he used to cut... speak louder in the mic, okay. Buckley's never told me that he used to cut heads off tuna, so I guess we'll have to be a subject at the next meeting, I guess. Our next speaker is Herb Clemens. I met Herb shortly after coming to Salt Lake 4 years ago. Herb has worked in Amnesty International for a long time, longer than most people care to remember. He's presently the coordinator for the Central American Co-Group for Amnesty International USA. The coordination group does research for El Salvador, Honduras, and Nicaragua. Herb's also a professor of mathematics here at the University of Utah.
Okay, my perspective on this will be a little different. It will, again, be a kind of personal history of involvement, but the religious aspect is another culture, another time. I came to Salt Lake, now it's been 13 years ago, and up to about 6 months before I came, had never been in Salt Lake City, had no idea I would be coming to Salt Lake City, and had just at that time begun working with Amnesty International. And so let me backtrack and say how I got involved in the organization. And the thing that I want to bring up for discussion is coming to Salt Lake and trying to get Amnesty International going in Utah. We had our first meeting, the first meeting of Amnesty International in Utah on December 10th, 1975, and it took about 10 years for the group to get bigger than five. So I want to talk about how that happened and how I see it coming to this city and this culture from outside. My background is heavily reactionary, unreconstructed Catholic. I went to Jesuit boarding schools from the age of 13, was protected from all the evils of society until age 22, and then went as a graduate student to the University of California at Berkeley in 1962. So... I fortunately kept some of my sanity through the cross currents of that period, but as you can imagine, everything that I ever thought was totally challenged, turned around, beaten upside down and backwards. This may sound I don't know, humorous, but the one common current through my religious formation and the Berkeley period was that of social responsibility. And the part of the Catholic upbringing and tradition that somehow stuck the most was the aspect of service to fellow man and remembering the situation and needs of other people in other places and other cultures. And so I come to that from Catholic religious training with a few side trips along the way, and the Catholic heritage is still with me, and I'm still involved in the Newman Center here. And my work in human rights comes out of those values. Very, very definitely. The
The Berkeley period, however, as you can imagine, that was those were the 60s and the free speech movement and every other kind of movement that you can possibly think of, challenged all of that from a religious perspective, but did not challenge the basic social involvement. The result of that was that I was just about to get my PhD in mathematics, somehow decided that being a research mathematician for the rest of my life was not a terrifically social thing to do without some other side of it. So I signed up for the Peace Corps. And as soon as I agree in mathematics, I went off to Santiago, Chile, to work in a master's degree program for a couple of years under the direction of a Chilean mathematician, the first PhD in mathematics that Chile had produced in its history. This is 1966, so this is not highly developed stuff. My work with Amnesty International came out of my work in Chile. I was there for 2 years from 66 to 68. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Chile's history during that period, but Chile had been one of the stable democracies of Latin America since the 19th century, except for one very brief period in the late 20s and early 30s. So when I went to Chile and looked at it politically, it seemed to me essentially equivalent to the United States in terms of, I mean, a much poorer country, not economically so developed, but in political institutions, as stable a place as you could imagine. So in that sense, I thought, you know, what are they sending me to Chile for? This is a more sophisticated political culture than we've got here. But the mathematical work was interesting, and it made something that was very personal for me before have a very a social component. We ran a large master's degree program for people who were teaching in universities in Chile. They would come in and spend 2 years with us full time, get a master's degree, and go back out to their jobs. So all that fit into place. But the political side, it seemed to me, especially, now the first time I was there was 66 through 68, and you remember that period in the United States and, well, many other places in the world. I mean, that was the time that cities were burning, that was Martin Luther King was assassinated, Robert Kennedy was assassinated, the war in Vietnam. Chile seemed an enormously mature, restrained place in that period. However, a reformist government, the Frei government, which is a Christian democratic government, came in 64, promised a lot, delivered some things, imposed its ideology on the political and social structure, and somehow did not deliver enough and was voted out in 1970. A socialist government came into power, led by Salvador Allende, who was the president during the period 70 to 73, to the States, started in my first job, went back down there again, taught for the year of 1970, and for 1972-73. And that was the period when Chile came apart. The society polarized over the issue of radical redistribution of resources and a socialist or mixed economy model. Most unfortunately, it polarized at about 50-50. And so there was a paralysis that set in, and you lived on your street, you knew what the politics of every person on the street, families were divided, the society came apart. And what that brought home to me was the perilously fragile nature of political system and civility in political system. Because in 1973, the military stepped in. There was a very bloody and repressive military coup, and many of the people with whom I worked who were on the wrong side were in jail. And I came back to the States a month before the coup took place, not knowing what was going to happen there. And during the next 3 or 4 years, spent a lot of time working to try to get friends of mine out of jail and out of the country, One person was the rector of the university where I worked, and he was an adopted prisoner of conscience of Amnesty International Group 33 in Stamford, Connecticut. So I joined Amnesty in 1974 and worked for his release and consequent exile because it was not safe for him to stay in Chile once he was out of jail. I came to Salt Lake. Yeah, I'm going a little long here. I will speed it up. I came to Salt Lake in 1975 and decided to start, try to start an amnesty group. So here at the University of Utah, we had our first meeting December 10th of 75, and we settled down for that first year as a group of about 5 to 6 people, all connected with the university in some form or another, faculty, graduate students. At that time and during the subsequent year, I made a very strong effort to get in contact with elements of the LDS Church, because it seemed to me that this was a natural, and it was a natural because of the mission system throughout the world. There would be an enormous number of people with language capability, with country experience, who had probably happened on exactly the kind of situations that I had experienced in Chile and people had experienced all over. Those efforts were not very successful, and part of the reason is my poor powers to convince and that of our small group, I am sure. But part of the difficulty, it was explained to me by people within the church who brought these issues up, was that the mission system of the church depends very, very heavily on good relations between the host government and the LDS church in the country. And that the kind of activist human rights work that we would do, protesting or calling into question the imprisonment of people who were politically active or viewed as people hostile to the government, could prejudice the work of the church in the country because it would sour relations with the government. And I would very much like during the question or discussion period that any of you who would like to do so to please comment on that and explain that to me. That seems to me to be a very important issue. I mean, it's not something that I would say, oh, they shouldn't worry about that. They should do human rights. I mean, it seems to me that that's an issue that that the church has to take on in everything that it does. And it sets priorities, and if the priorities are religious before social, it may have to take that stand in a country. I'm an outsider. I don't know how that fits in the Mormon religious philosophy. So I put that out to you as a question. Over the years, Amnesty has gotten going. Our philosophy was, you know, just keep a presence. Even if we don't do anything, have the name somewhere in the state, and eventually groups will form and it will start to flourish. And it never happened while I was running local groups. But when Mike and some of the people came about 3 or 4 years ago, all of a sudden there are 4 or 5 Amnesty groups throughout in various places. There's a group associated with Brigham Young. There's a group associated with Weber State. There's a group up in Logan. There are adoption groups in Ogden and in Salt Lake. And to me, this is fantastic. I mean, this is, you know, 50 people or 75 people or 100 people in the state somehow involved in Amnesty is terrific. So I will leave it at that point with that question that I posed to you and ask you please to, if you have comments on that, to do so during the question period. In order to do a little of my local work while I'm at it, if any of you are interested in writing letters on behalf of prisoners, Amnesty runs what's called an Urgent Action Network, which is when someone is imprisoned and there is, because of past history, danger of mistreatment or that the person's actual physical well-being is jeopardized, they put out urgent actions. We work now, my little group of four people work strictly on Honduras, Nicaragua, and Salvador. So I brought a recent urgent action on Honduras. If any of you are interested in writing a letter on behalf of the case that I brought, please see me at the end, and I have tons of copies of a little sheet, and I'll explain it to you and give you a copy. Thank you very much.
Shortly after coming to Salt Lake, one of the first things I did was go with the executive director, Jack Healy, of Amnesty International, down to BYU. He had a speaking engagement down there. He spoke for the next 3 years in a row down there. The last time he was there, he admonished them because they hadn't started a group there. But every year, the students had tried to start something, and because of administration problems, nothing ever got started. So this last year, they figured a way around it, and with the help of our next speaker, Gerald Davis, they started Students for Human Rights Group, which writes letters for Amnesty International and for other human rights groups in the USA. Professor Davis is a professor of German down at BYU, and I guess that's sufficient. Thank you.
I hadn't. Is this working at all? I guess it is. I hadn't thought about saying anything about my personal involvement with Amnesty or human rights, but maybe I could just give you a brief preface to tell you how I sort of got more actively involved. In 1980, I was with a group of BYU students. I was directing a study program in Vienna, Austria. And I had two sons with me, one Jeff, 19, Bill, 21. And they had a friend, Peter Bergstrom, from Sweden, who was also a BYU student, and Peter's mother, who was an art, a sculptress from Sweden, who had come down to visit with us. She was a friend of my wife, who teaches art history. And they had gone down to Italy to see some sculpture in Florence, and then had gone down to Greece, and were coming back up to Vienna. And the date of August 2nd, 1980, probably doesn't mean a lot to you, but of course it's an important date to me, because on that morning my son Bill called me from Bologna, Italy, and said there's been a delay in the train, we'll have to stay in the Bologna train station for 3 hours, and so we'll be a little late getting back. About 15 minutes after he called, Peter Bergstrom's mother called us in Vienna, and very hysterical, and said there's been a terrible explosion in the train station, terrorists have blown up the train station, both of your sons are badly injured in the hospital, my son is in the hospital. She didn't happen to be directly in line of the explosion, and so we had to jump in a car, rush down to Bologna, and found out that they had been involved in what the newspaper were calling the worst attack on a civilian population since the Second World War, which 80 people were killed and 200 injured through that terrorist attack. And my older son, who was a returned missionary from Germany and who had been in school, was a little bit, wasn't injured so badly that he couldn't talk to the newspaper reporters, and was on television, and they asked him what he had learned or thought about this experience. And he said something that impressed me very much when he said, well, I've learned in the last day that no political action of any kind can be justified through the use of force. And the rest of the story was, of course, long rehabilitation for others. Unfortunately, they neither were killed. They were badly injured. But when I came back, then I became a member of Amnesty International and worked as a sort of an individual for many years, just receiving their mail and paying my dues each year. But I saw the same thing that was mentioned here when Jack Healy came to Provo a year ago, or I guess it's been about a year now, and was a little bit upset. It was reported in the paper because there was no chapter on the BYU campus. And I wondered why there wasn't a chapter on BYU campus, so I met Gary and Jill Keeley, who had been active in the Provo group of Amnesty. And then through a good friend, Lamont Tullis, who is one of the vice presidents down there now, we worked through the administration trying to find out why we could. And apparently there is a problem, and it may relate to the question that you brought up, too. The university there wants to maintain strict autonomy and independence and does not like student clubs to have national affiliations where they become in any way dependent upon the national affiliation. And so we managed then to organize a group called Students for Human Rights, which does not have any direct affiliation. That is, we don't receive money from any national organization. We can write and pay money to receive information and such things, but we're trying to work with several human rights groups, Amnesty, of course, being the largest and most active, is the one that we work with most directly as far as writing letters and so on, but we do receive information from other organizations, Helsinki Watch and Humanitas, the Joan Baez organization in California, and other human rights organizations. And we've been off to a pretty good start this just toward the end of the winter semester and into the spring. We start our first meetings. We try to meet weekly, and every other week we try to have a speaker. We've had Ted Lyon talk about human rights in South America. We've had Gary Browning talking about human rights in the Soviet Union, and Professor Dan Peterson talking about human rights in the Near East. These have been good stimulus to bring people out, and then at the end of the meetings we write letters, and then on the alternate weeks we also write letters. And we've had generally about 40 or 50 students at each meeting and about a half a dozen or a dozen faculty members, and we think that when we get organized this next fall it will grow, and we're hoping that we can do a lot more work in that way. That's sort of how I got directly involved in what I wasn't what I intended to say here. I have a short, sort of more formal statement, which I wrote on human rights from a religious perspective, as I see it as a member of the LDS Church. And I'll read that to you now. It's only 4 pages long, so it won't take much time. Then we can have questions. Working to defend human rights is encouraged and even admonished by several well-known scriptures. The injunction to help the unfortunate and oppressed, the widows, the orphans, the sick, the hungry, the imprisoned, is certainly an apostolic injunction, in spite of Martin Luther's wry comment that the Epistle of James is, he called, an epistle of straw. We turn frequently to James for our encouragement to Christian action in behalf of persons in need of help. James goes so far as to call this type of service pure religion, undefiled before God. But the injunction to humanitarian service is more than apostolic. It is clearly dominical. Our Lord's declarations about visiting those in prison, providing aid to the oppressed, helping the unfortunate, the poor and needy, are ubiquitous in the Scriptures. Consider, for example, the many parables in this regard, the Good Shepherd, the Samaritan, the debtor who is forgiven and not cast into prison, etc. And all of these injunctions and moral lessons are embraced by the beautiful conclusion, "If you have done it unto the least of these, my brethren, you have done it unto me." These truths about humanitarian service in behalf of human rights we hold to be self-evident. I would therefore like you to think for a few moments of human rights in a somewhat broader religious perspective. The basis for all human activity, seems to me, is our God-given free will or free agency, and what we label human rights is nothing more than our natural God-given right to act according to this free will. We are too inclined, I believe, to think of human rights as political rights, and from some very narrow perspective, even as political rights promulgated by a particular wing of world politics. Human rights are not political, or we would call them political rights. They are human rights. They are rights we as humans on this planet have agreed are basic to all human beings without regard to political perspectives. The International Declaration of Human Rights makes this abundantly clear. And I was very pleased to read a statement by one of the general authorities of the LDS Church in a recent issue of the Church News, which also makes this abundantly clear. As most of you will know, about a year ago, the LDS Church raised from voluntary contributions about $13 million to aid the people of Northern Africa. As has been reported by President Hinckley, most of this money is being distributed by a relief agency of the Catholic Church and by the International Red Cross for the immediate relief of hunger and starvation. Some of the contributed funds are being used by the LDS Church, however, for long-term irrigation and agricultural projects that are intended to help prevent such widespread famine and in the future. As most of you will also know, there has been some criticism of African relief agencies because of the political differences existing in Northern Africa. Recently, however, two general authorities of the LDS Church were touring Northern Africa to oversee some of the results of the relief work of the church. Elder Nelson was quoted in the Church News, and I was so pleased to read this. "We saw no communists, we saw no capitalists, we saw only hungry people." If human rights is not a political issue, where exactly do these rights fit as seen from a religious perspective? As I suggested above, I believe that all human rights are simply the right to exercise the most basic of all religious rights, our free agency. We have often heard or read erudite arguments about the distinction between freedom and free agency or free will. Freedom, the argument goes, can be curtailed, can be restricted, can be taken away, but free agency remains regardless of the external circumstances. A person illegally arrested and placed in a dungeon is deprived of his basic human right to freedom. But the argument goes, this person retains his basic religious and God-given right to free agency or free will. This, it seems to me, is a sophistic and even dangerous distinction. Let me illustrate using an example from literature, and since I'm a professor of German, it has to be from German literature. Goethe's Faust exerts all of his mental and physical energies over a very long life struggling to discover the meaning of existence, or as he metaphorically puts it, to find what holds the earth together at its innermost core. Early in this quest, we find Faust in his study translating the Greek New Testament into modern German. And it is very significant that Faust begins his translation with the familiar passage, Im Anfang war die Tat, in the beginning was the Word. Seeking an inspired translation to the Greek Logos, Faust finally concludes that a more holistic translation would be, in the beginning was the act, the Tat. Behind the word lies meaning, he argues, and behind the meaning lies the power to act. To this extent, we have a concept of free agency, and the will and the power to act, and the will and the power to act, and are reminded of the familiar scripture, Verily I say, men should be anxiously engaged in a good cause and do many things of their own free will, and bring to pass much righteousness, for the power is in them, wherein they are agents unto themselves. But returning to Faust, even though we may have the will and the power, if the act remains undone, the wholeness of the word remains unrealized. And what Faust discovers at the end of a very long earthly existence is that this existence becomes meaningful on this earth and beyond to the degree that human beings emulate the creative power of God in acting for the benefit of their fellow human beings. It is for that reason that Goethe, through Faust, concludes, in the beginning was the creative or the divine act. Consequently, my argument here is that any restriction of human rights is, from a religious perspective, a restriction of mankind's basic God-given free will. Free agency, the right and the will to act, remain always a potential until one does act. The free will to speak is of little value when the right to speak freely is taken away. A person may have all the free will in the world to do good for his or her fellow humans, but if she or he is illegally restrained from speaking or writing, perhaps even illegally imprisoned, then this free will remains only a potential. Therefore, any abridgment of human rights is an abridgment of free agency. The total and ultimate function of free agency is to act in emulation of and like God. To understand and to act like God is to be like God in fulfillment of the injunction, Be ye therefore perfect, even as my Father in heaven is perfect. An abridgment of one's human rights is, therefore, an abridgment of mankind's potential and embryonic divinity. Looking at human rights from this religious perspective places the defense of human rights within a category of moral imperatives for all humans. It is not a political injunction that asks us to love and defend human rights. It is a divine injunction.
Thank you. Questions now, if you'd like to direct them at anyone in particular, point that out. Otherwise, we'll just let whoever wants to answer them grab the mic. Yes.
Yeah, the Catholic Church, on social issues, there is every point of view that one can imagine. In some countries, for historical or whatever reason, the Catholic Church and its hierarchy maintain tight control on what goes on and are very closely aligned to the local government. Sometimes in situations that one would blush at, in the sense that these are not governments whose human rights records are terrific. In other places, the Catholic Church has been in the forefront of protecting human rights organizations from government, interferences, too kind a word. One such place is Chile, as a matter of fact. The Vicaría de la Solidaridad, which is the main internal human rights organization in Chile, which has been able to survive over the years and deal with the people who have been released from prison and subjected to torture and protest killings and try to find people who have disappeared and all of that. That exists because the church in Chile, for the reason of the leadership there, has been quite active. Nicaragua is another case where you see a complete dichotomy. The hierarchy of the church is very strongly opposed to the Sandinista government, the current government. However, there is a, if you want to call it, liberation theology-based movement, a grassroots church, which is totally on the other side. So in that sense, I would say that the parallel with Mormonism is not so correct, because I would say looking at it from my perspective, the LDS Church has a more, actually more of a line and more control over the attitude of, say, missionaries or people of the LDS Church working in those countries. Yeah.
Just so I can keep the people who raise their hands in order, I have a question here and one back there, and then I'll go from there.
Yeah, I asked the public communications office that if there'd ever been a case even of a member of the church. And in their research, they said there had not even been a member of the church imprisoned for religious views or for conscious views. Frankly, I think they were looking in the wrong place. I can't believe that nowhere in the world. I mean, I know some of my own. I mean, think of during the war, good heavens. And there have been so many other places. Even on my own mission, I saw it. I did see missionaries who were thrown in jail for one reason or another and got pulled out. But by intervention of the mission president through help from Salt Lake. But I guess they don't consider that really the same sort of thing.
Maybe I could say one word on that. I have a son who just returned a year ago from Haiti, where he was for 2 years, and was there when baby Doc Duvalier was deposed and went and saw all of the political agitation there. And at the time, if I were writing any letters to Haiti, and we get a lot of urgent action requests from Haiti because they're also not so hot on civil rights right now, I was very reluctant to sign my name to those letters. I would often use a pseudonym because knowing that my own son was there and coming from Brigham Young University, and it's very easy to associate the LDS missionaries with Brigham Young University, and so I was a little bit cautious. And also, partly in answer to your question, he has told me of examples where missionaries were threatened, in one case shot, but they were not publicized because, for the same reason, if they were to go to make large protests to General Namphy, for example, about the way he treated missionaries, it would probably make it worse for the other missionaries who were there. So generally when these things happen, I think they try to resolve them as quietly as possible, rather than involving any other agencies. At least that's the experience that I've had personally.
Next question right here.
Could I ask a question on the
sure.
basis of...
Yeah.
What did, I've been told that part of the reason for the decisions of the kind that you just alluded to, part of that is theological, that it is a basic tenet of Mormon faith to obey civil authority to the point in which you personally experience or see something which is unjust, and then you are expected to go to the wall to defend against that injustice that you see. My question, I guess, to you and to others here, is the basis of this theological, or is the basis of this practical in the sense of the continued existence of the church? So of those two things which you just mentioned, the obedience to civil authority and the protection of human rights, which I think that goes back to my first question, which of those is more fundamental in Mormon belief system? Yeah, that's my question, yeah.
The gentleman in the green shirt, please.
Yeah, in general, I'm not confident to comment on that. I will say one thing is that a pattern that you see in Latin America very frequently is that an order priest, it may be a Jesuit, it may be a Franciscan, Dominican, goes and works essentially permanently in Mexico or Chile or Venezuela or wherever, and you will see a transition over time from a position of rather orthodox Catholic thought to assimilation into the needs of the local population. And sometimes, I mean, it takes very radical turns. I mean, there are some gun-toting priests in the hills of Colombia who essentially left their priesthood in order to become revolutionaries. I mean, that's that does not happen often, but certainly the social viewpoint undergoes a transition. The result of that has been, though, conflict with church hierarchy. And you see that now. I mean, the Jesuits, which started out as defenders of the papacy in their early history, are now in big trouble with Rome, and frequently exactly on these kinds of issues, the issues of liberation theology or some modified nonviolent version of that. So the contradiction that is being posed here is played out in Catholicism, I think, equally, and is equally unresolved.
Yeah. I know from a church perspective, and I was a missionary 20 years ago in Colombia, and we had free rein to walk in and out of the country anytime we wanted. Our visas were unlimited. As many North Americans could come in and out as missionaries as we wanted, and the church had been open there for about 18 months when I first got in. So we were... I mean, the old-timers have been in the church 9 months and were being put in branch presidency. So it was pioneering days then. Today, the church does not have that freewheeling reign that they had. So all of the cautions we were given to stay out of local politics and all of that, I don't think did much good. And I think you'll find that I've asked many missionaries this question, and the same thing happens. It didn't make any difference. It really didn't cement anything. We got some converts, certainly, but it didn't make a whole lot of difference. And the issue also about missionaries and do they not have time? We're encouraged to study the language, and part of that language is the culture, and it depends very much on who your mission president is. But I had three on my mission, and one of them was very supportive of learning about the culture, and I memorized Peruvian poets in Spanish and did other similar things. But I would say that that's the exception in my experience, and most missionaries could hardly wait to get back to a place that had root beer. It was the most important thing on their mind.
Okay. Next question down here, please.
Do you want to take that, Mike?
Sure.
Yeah, Mike is central guru now.
Yeah, right. Well, that's a title I can live with, I guess. The things that we do here in Utah, the main function so far has been to adopt a prisoner of conscience, and he was released 2 years ago. Since that time, we've been working to educate the public on human rights abuses. A lot of people don't realize that a third of the countries in the world use torture on a regular basis. We've come out strongly against the death penalty in Utah, and that's got us a lot of publicity. Most people think that that's all we do. It's not. Writing letters is our main thing. Education is our second thing. We try to go out to churches, to any group that wants us to come out and talk to them. We tell them about human rights and countries if they want specifics, and we tell them that they can write letters. Letter writing is very effective. Sending telegrams is very effective. One thing that we've seen because of our letter writing and our telegrams is that countries have changed their habits. It used to be very easy for Amnesty International to find people to adopt as prisoners of conscience. Lately, it's become harder and harder because governments, though they haven't given up abusing human rights, have turned to quicker methods. They pick people up, they torture them, they put them back on the street in 3 days. They pick them up, they kill them, they throw them in a ditch. So our response now is quick actions through the Urgent Action Network. So, but it's still our basic thing is letter writing. It's very effective.
There's a international office in London that's funded by all the national sections that has a couple hundred research people who, you know, research cases, develop contacts over the years. There are two general things. The organization tries as best it can to work for people who are nonviolent, whose human rights in some form or another have been violated. It also works to prevent torture and execution of all prisoners, irrespective of what their crime is. So in anything of this type, I mean, we make mistakes. I think we make mistakes for two reasons. One is that it's an enormous job for an organization that is privately funded and only started 25 years ago worldwide. And I think I have to say, in all honesty also, we make mistakes because of the frank political biases of the people that get involved. I mean, and I say that as an admission in my own case and many other cases. Sometimes our organization has not been as sharp as it could have been on issues, I think, because, if you want to say so, people, a lot of soft-hearted, hard-on-the-sleeve liberals get involved in these organizations. So we're in a situation of institutional repression like the Soviet Union. I mean, that's clear and has been clear for a long time, and we deal with that, I think, pretty well. We were slow off the mark against repression in Nicaragua. That's, I mean, an admission I'll make, and that's a case where we didn't judge well. We didn't realize the number of political imprisonments that there were in Nicaragua. We were late in Cambodia. I mean, like many, many, many other organizations in the world, but we were late to that. We somehow could not bring ourselves to understand the level of slaughter that took place. We were late in Cuba in the early 60s, again, I think. So sometimes we haven't been, we have judged poorly. Saying all that, one thing that keeps me going in the organization, I see people who come early into the organization all gung-ho about doing something and those terrible people and these good people and all of that, becoming, in some sense, much less politically charged and much, well, I hate to use the word purer because it's not the right word, but narrowing their agenda to straight blind human rights concerns over the years. And so I think as you work in the organization, you get better at it. And that also goes for our research staff as well. So that would be my assessment of how we deal with that.
Okay, next question, please. We have time for just a few more questions, please. We are one restriction that we put on all amnesty members is that they don't work on human rights abuses except for the death penalty in their own countries. The reason for that is if you do it in El Salvador, you get picked up and murdered. That happens all the time. So we restrict our members not to write to the government about torture and that sort of thing in their own countries.
I mean, there have been adopted prisoners in the United States, especially one period in recent history that comes to mind is the early 60s in the civil rights movement. People who were jailed in the South were adopted by amnesty groups in Sweden or West Germany or wherever. But amnesty groups in the United States would not work on those cases. Once the organization decided to take a stand against the death penalty worldwide because it saw it as an abuse in the way that it was being used worldwide, groups were allowed to work against the death penalty in their own country. Why that is, I personally don't know. It seems to me to conflict a little bit with this, I think, very good idea of getting pressure from abroad rather than from within your own country on these issues.
I think the reason is because it's a states' rights issue here, and it's not.
Return to just very briefly to the comment about Germany during the Second World War and the LDS Church, because it seems to me we have there a very classic example which could become a model for the Church's behavior in other places like Central America now, and that is the notorious case of Helmut Huebner and his two friends in Hamburg, which has been published recently by Deseret Book, a book called The Price, which is essentially a series of interviews with Karl-Heinz Schnibbe, who lives here in Salt Lake City, who's one of the survivors of that group of three, interviews done by Doug Tober in history and Alan Keel in German at BYU. And the book has now been published in German in a much expanded edition. But there it was, a small Brandenburg, which was trying to sort of get along with the Nazi government in the early 40s, not cause any trouble so they could continue to exist. But three young teenagers who had access to BBC and who knew English and who had former affiliation with American missionaries, so they had some sympathies with America rather than with the German propaganda, and under the leadership of this boy, Hübner, took it upon themselves to print and distribute anti-Nazi pamphlets, run off on the, because one of them was a clerk in the branch and had access to a duplicating machine, going to the church at night, running off the pamphlets, distributing around the city, survived for about 9 months, and then were found and arrested. Hübner, the leader, was executed, as most of you who've read the episode know. The other two got away with 5 and 10 years imprisonment, but then ended up in the German army. The interesting thing is that the organization to which they belonged, this little branch, the most of the members were like the other German members who were trying to survive, who were afraid of the Nazis and trying to keep quiet, didn't want anyone causing any trouble. The branch president apparently was a little bit of a Nazi sympathizer. In fact, when Hübner was executed, wrote excommunicated on his membership record, which then after the war, when the church got back into Germany again after 5 years, wrote, you know, a letter saying that this was done without proper authority and he was not excommunicated. But it was just sort of an example of an individual who decided to act that he had reached the edge of his conscience, could no longer operate, you know, without acting against the government, and did, and it cost him his life. But I suspect that that's going to happen more and more as the church has these experiences. In fact, it is happening now, but it's not highly publicized in places like Uruguay. But anyway, the Hübner story, it seems to me, is going to become more and more of a classic example of a Mormon whose individual conscience finally won't take anymore. And the other example is Bruno Stroganoff, who was an SS officer in Germany, who was a Mormon, who then resigned his commission when it was said he would fight in Russia as a soldier, but wouldn't participate. He was sent to Poland and wouldn't participate in actions against the Jews, and he was put in prison and actually survived the war in prison, and then later came back, became a branch president in Heidelberg, and is living in Germany now. So there are some examples of this on smaller scale.
I believe I have time for just one more quick question in the back, please.
Amnesty tries as best it can to not take a political position on the evolution of South Africa. For instance, Nelson Mandela is not a prisoner of conscience because Nelson Mandela advocates violence. But the institution of apartheid is the organization sees as an instrument of denial of human rights. So while they take no position on the existence of the South African white government or whatever, they do take a position on apartheid and on the exile, internal exile, which is essentially what the townships and some of Lesotho and some of those places are. So,
that's clear.
Amnesty has taken positions against violence by opposition groups, by guerrilla groups, by in Latin America, the Red Brigade, all of those. But it sees its primary mission as reviewing and calling attention to human rights abuses by governments, because it feels that governments have a special obligation to protect the rights of their citizens. And also the operative philosophical document for the organization is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, to which the governments of the world are signatories. So in that sense, we do not do as much and we wouldn't adopt someone who was being held by an opposition group. We would publicize that when we could, but we get our groups to communicate with governments, to remind governments of their duty under the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And most human rights organizations have difficulty dealing with opposition groups unless they become essentially they control a territory and become a government, because in some sense there is very little instrument of contact and also for pressure. These groups do not take responsibility for the welfare of their citizens like a government does. So that's a weakness in the human rights movement, which is reflected in Amnesty International and most other human rights organizations. Yeah.
I'd like to thank you all for coming, and thank Sunstone for having us today. If anyone would like some more information on Amnesty International, I'd be happy to send it to them if they give me their name and address and such. Thank you.